We're excited to announce that our very own podcasting platform, Zencastr, has become a new sponsor to the show. Check out the podcast discount link in our show notes and stay tuned for why we love using Zen for the podcast.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to The Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello and welcome to The Archaeology Show, episode 110.
On today's show, we talk about 3,000-year-old royal purple textile, Neanderthal teeth with Homo sapien characteristics, and the Chumash using shell beads as currency up to 2,000 years ago.
Let's dig a little deeper. Welcome to the show, everyone. And as usual, I am Chris Webster, and I'm joined by my wife, Rachel Roden.
Hello.
And we are recording just because I like to say where we're at, because we're always in someplace different. But we were recording from Fort Myers Beach, Florida, in the beginning of February, and we're about to have a wicked thunderstorm. So I don't know if that's going to happen while we're recording or not, but who knows? Could be.
Yeah, we'll see. It doesn't look real great out there. Also, we're what, maybe 2 hours south of where the Super Bowl is about to happen today, too?
Yeah.
So our plan is to basically just not leave the RV today.
Yeah, yeah. Especially since the Super Bowl is already being called a super spreader event and hasn't even happened yet.
Ooh, because yeah.
Because people are gathering, so.
Yep, no, we'll stay away from that.
We're, as usual, isolated in our RV thinking about archaeology news and events. So there you go.
Yeah, and I am so excited about this first article. I definitely picked this one out specifically, and I turned to you and I said, I found this article. I don't care what you want to talk about on the archaeology show this week, but this article is one of them because it is something that is so near and dear to my heart. It is all about dyed textile. And if you guys know anything about me from previous episodes, you know that yarn and knitting is a passion of mine. And recently there was an article, or there was a discovery of purple dyed fabric in Israel. And the reason that this is so exciting is because it is the oldest example of dyed textile and yarn, or actually I think it was wool fibers, but the oldest example of this found in, I think, the world at this point. It's very rare to find this stuff. And this is a super, super old example, 3,000 years-ish old. So obviously I'm very excited.
Yeah. And a lot of people reported on this. We'll link to a couple different articles, one from The Independent and one from Sci News. And they were all reported near the end of January 2021. Mm-hmm. There's some good pictures from the excavation. And, you know, kind of the interesting thing is where this is discovered in Israel, people are always looking for the, I guess, the palace of King David.
Yeah.
And you know, King David was in the Bible, you know, regardless of what you think about the Bible and religion, David was a real person. Mm-hmm. So there is that, or at least we think he was, because there's plenty of other historical references to King David,
right?
Not just in the Bible,
right?
And King Solomon as well. And this was discovered around that time, and people are looking. And since this was such a rare color because of the, we'll talk about this later, but because of the difficulty in obtaining this color.
Yeah, like the manufacturing process to get this color is really difficult.
Yeah, they said this is worth more than if you were to find gold.
Yeah.
Like this color is worth more than gold, a colored dyed fabric of this type.
Yeah, it's like that true royal purple. And there's a picture of it that we'll link to, but it's just like the most beautiful shade of like purple violet almost. It's mm-hmm. so vibrant. And I can't believe that I'm looking at something that is 3,000 years old. Obviously, it was incredibly well preserved to have such a beautiful tone and color to it. And it's just so cool to see that, because I like seek out that color with non-natural dyes. And to know that that purple was created with a natural dye just like made my wool and knitter and yarn dyer heart just so excited and happy.
Now, I don't know if I read this as closely as you did. Maybe they don't even mention this. You got to go back to the Plus One journal article, but does it say what kind of fabric it is?
Well, I saw that there was a tassel, it looked like, a bit of a woven fabric. And then the picture that I saw is of the actual like wool fibers. It's like just like a handful of unprocessed wool fibers that have been dyed.
Like, what's the story with that, I wonder, with this being an archaeological site. I'm not really sure what the site actually is and what this archaeological site is, but why would you have unspun just fibers laying on the ground?
Yeah, that is interesting.
If they're so valuable.
Right. So the site itself is an ancient copper production district, and I don't know what, they don't really go into detail as to where specifically in this district it was, but it's a sort of an industrial area, if you can call it that, for 3,000 years ago. It's where they're producing things. And in this copper production district, they had previously found pots that had remnants of the purple dye in it, and also the snails that they use themselves to extract the color from, they found remnants of those snails as well. So they knew that they were doing something with the purple dye in this area, but they hadn't found any evidence specifically of the final product, the textile, if you will. So finding this woven fabric remnants and the tassel shows that end product, and then finding the wool dyed with it, that tells me that they were dyeing the wool before they even spun it into fiber, which is super interesting because oftentimes today we're dyeing wool that has already been spun. It gives you more flexibility. Like, you can buy a whole bunch of undyed fiber and then dye it to whatever color you want and be on your merry way with your project. But it sounds like back in the day, perhaps they were dyeing the unspun wool first and then spinning it. Maybe they got better depth of color. Maybe it was a better use of the dye itself to dye the wool first. I'm not really sure why they would do that, but you can do it either way. And this is evidence of that process right there. So
could have been just economics too. Maybe the person or company, for lack of a better way to say that, but the organization or whoever that was sourcing these mollusks and doing the distillation process to get that color was the source of the dye for this, but then they sent it off to somebody else to get spun. Like, they sold it to get spun.
Yeah, and yeah. I imagine they had some control over what type of yarn they were spinning the wool into, so it could have been very thin for very finely woven garments. It could have been a little thicker for something warmer, and there's a lot of options. So dyeing the wool first gave them that flexibility to spin the wool specifically for whatever final product they were trying to create. So, and I guess there could be some reason for like decorative purposes to leave some of it unspun as well. Although I'm really struggling to think of what that would be, because you can use unspun wool fibers as like stuffing and even as like felted on decoration, but I just can't imagine they were doing anything like that back then. So maybe scratch that idea. It's probably not what they were doing, but yeah, maybe, I mean, who I don't knows? Know. Yeah. I don't know.
One thing I think is cool with this highly advanced technique of, not necessarily technique of dyeing, but the technique of extracting from the mollusks, and you got to be in an area where you can find those snails.
Yep.
And then not only that, but have the understanding for how to get it out of them. Like, what do you boil them? Or do you just make them scare themselves and they excrete the dye? I mean, what do you do?
I don't know. I read a little bit about the process, but it sounds like they extract whatever they use to make the dye. They extract it from glands near the rectum of these Mediterranean snails.
Squeezing
purple dye out of snail butts? I don't know.
I wonder if that kills the snail, or if you can just harvest a bunch of snails and then squeeze it out of them and let them grow some more.
Like squid ink. I don't know.
It's along the same lines of squid ink, probably. Squid.
Actually,
yeah.
They must be killing them, because if they could reuse these snails over and over to get more out, then it wouldn't be so rare. You know, they would have snail farms producing this stuff if it were right. a renewable resource, if you will. So my guess is that it was not renewable at all, and that they had to kill them to get it.
The interesting thing about this site and this area right here is it was a vast copper mine, they said, a vast ancient copper mine.
Yeah.
And it also says that the Iron Age equivalent of modern day oil. Copper smelting required advanced expert understanding that was a guarded secret, and those who held the knowledge were considered high-tech experts of the time. So in this one area, you've got people smelting copper, which is apparently really crazy thing to do, and not very many people knew how to do it. But you also have people doing this like high-tech purple dye thing, which was rare.
Yeah,
so what's going on here?
Well, I'm sure it was closely guarded secret as well to be such a highly valued product.
Oh, you don't want just
product.
Peasants having purple.
Yeah, no, obviously. That's only for the kings and the royals. Purple is so special. But I think it's really cool that they finally found actual fabric and wool.
Now let's talk about why the purple was so sought after. Didn't people have probably just by accident basic understanding of like the color wheel? Can't you make purple from mixing other colors?
Well, I think with natural dyeing, it's just a little bit less reliable. Because of course they can make blue with indigo, and they could make red probably.
There's lots of ways to make red.
I think it comes from like a bug that you can grind up and turn into red, and there's some other options too.
Yeah, ochre in this side of the world.
Yeah, that too. Yeah, so
iron-based stuff.
Yeah, yeah. So there's lots of ways to make red, but I'm not sure it would make a reliably bright and vibrant purple, mm-hmm. not like the one that these create. So that's probably why. Also, dyeing yarn is just—it's such a chemically complex process for ancient societies to be doing, because you can't just dump a bunch of yarn or fiber or whatever into a pot and call it good. You can with some things like indigo, you can do that because it has a natural substance in it that will bind to the fabric or the yarn. But not everything has that, and you have to add what's called a mordant to it. And the mordant, what we use these days is like it's like an aluminum type of thing, aluminum sulfate. But I don't know what they would have used back in ancient times as a mordant, because obviously I don't think they knew how to get their hands on something like aluminum sulfate. But basically, you need another chemical to truly permanently bind the dye particles to the wool or the cotton or the flax or whatever it is that you're trying to dye. And wool and animal fibers are way easier to dye than cotton and plant fibers are too. So that's another like complex thing that's happening. So anyway, the whole process is quite complex, and I would be interested to know more about chemically how they do it, because that would have made it even harder to do and then therefore more valuable end product.
Yeah, I suppose so.
Yep.
So, all right. Well, we are going to take a short break and transition from purple dye in royalty to a little bit older Neanderthals and humans having sex. I don't think there was any purple involved there.
I mean, probably not, but hey, never count it out. We all know that Neanderthals are much more than we have given them credit for. So
that's true. That's true. And apparently the Homo sapien women felt the same way. So, and maybe the men. I don't know how which direction it went, but we're going to talk about that on the other side of the break. Chris Webster here for the Archaeology Podcast Network. We strive for high quality interviews and content so you can find information on any topic in archaeology from around the world. One way we do that is by recording interviews with our hosts and guests located in many parts of the world all at once. We do that through the use of Zencastr. That's Zencastr. Zencastr allows us to record high quality audio with no stress on the guest. Just send them a link to click on and that's it. Zencastr does the rest. They even do automatic transcriptions. Check out the link in the show notes for 30% off your first 3 months, or go to zencastr.com and use the code TAS. Looking to expand your knowledge of x-rays and imaging in the archaeology field? Then check out An Introduction to Paleoradiography, a short online course offering professional training for archaeologists and affiliated disciplines. Created by archaeologist, radiographer, and lecturer James Elliott, the content of this course is based upon his research and teaching experience in higher education. It is approved by the Chartered Institute for Archaeologists as 4 hours of training. That's in the UK, for those of you that don't know. So don't miss out on this exciting opportunity for professional and personal development. For more information on price and course structure, visit paleoimaging.com. That's P-A-L-E-O imaging.com. And look for the link in the show notes to this episode. Welcome back to the Archaeology Show, segment 2, episode 110. And now we're shifting gears, as I said, and we're going to the UK, sort of, and we are going to Neanderthals and Homo sapiens. And I say we're going to the UK, sort of, because it's not sort of. It really is the UK.
It is the UK,
but
yeah.
It really didn't feel like it. We're going to an island called Jersey, which I would assume is Old Jersey. I don't know if the people who started New Jersey came from Jersey, but
I don't know.
This island is part of a island chain called the Channel Islands, and it's between England and France, the southern end of England and France. And from Jersey, which is the largest island in this chain, first off, I don't know which islands are independently governed by who, but Jersey is one island. There's another island next door that's probably the next biggest one called Guernsey. There's another mm-hmm. island next door where there's like no cars and it's just like a monastery and some people that live there. I can't remember what the name of that island is, but I've been there too. But I spent time on Jersey about probably 3 months when I was between my last 2 years of college. I won't say junior and senior year of college because that was like, I was in like 3 senior years of college, I think. I don't really know at this point. But anyway, my last 2 years of college, I went there because I had a friend who was at the University of North Dakota with me. She ended up getting deported because she was a reporter and the news station just couldn't justify having her on. And legally they had to be able to do that, but their reporters are a dime a dozen. So she got booted back to England, but she found a job with the BBC and said, come over anytime. So I did and spent 3 months over there. And it was super cool. Got to see a lot of things. And one of the things I didn't see, though, because I didn't know it was there, was the Paleolithic site of Le Côte de Saint-Brélade in Jersey. And this was originally excavated. Well, the article we're going to talk about had an original excavation of 1910, 1911. So mm-hmm. people have been there working on this stuff for a long time. Before I go too much farther, though, let me give you a little brief history from my recollection of Jersey, which I think is super cool. I was there in 2004, and that was their 800-year anniversary of basically independence, because they were jointly ruled by England and France. And 800 years ago, well, 815, 16, 17 years ago, they were given the choice, basically, by England and France. They're like, you know what? We're tired of fighting over you guys, so why don't you guys just choose?
Oh, I didn't know that.
And they chose England.
Okay.
So while I was there, they had their big holiday that they have, which was their, I don't remember what they even called it, but some holiday that celebrates that independence. I guess it's probably just their Independence Day, mm-hmm. to be honest. Now, they're still under the UK, but they have their own money, and yet you can still use pounds there, yeah. like British pounds, but they have their own branded Jersey money. Guernsey has its own money. Mm-hmm. Guernsey's also independently run. Mm-hmm. I think they have like maybe a seat in Parliament or something like that in the UK, but they're not like a county or whatever you would call it of England. They're mm-hmm. just, I don't know, maybe it's just like Scotland. Mm. I couldn't tell you.
I don't know.
Did Scotland have its own money? I don't even remember. Or did we just use British pounds?
No, we just use pounds.
Yeah. Well, Jersey has its own money. It's really strange.
Yeah, that's cool interesting.
Another cool thool about Jersey, which really brings us along, is when at low tide, you can practically walk to France. Now, you'd have to walk pretty quick because the tide, you know, I don't think you could get there slogging through the water quick enough. But
yeah, but that's interesting, though.
Well, the real interesting thing is in the time period that we're talking about, when Neanderthals and humans, you know, 30 plus thousand years ago, mm-hmm. were coexisting together in this area, at various points in various ice age cycles, you could legit walk from England to
right.
France. Like even 6,000 years ago, there was connected lands where you could walk from England to France. And then there's been lots of, people like to think of the last ice age as like the ice age, but there's been thousands
many
of ice
them.
Ages.
Yeah.
And in the Paleolithic, during that cycle, water levels were lower and you could legit just walk straight across the English Channel in various points. I think at the south end and at the north end.
Yeah.
It was connected.
Yeah. When I first read this article, I was like, wait, Neanderthal and Jersey? Like how in the world? But
how'd they get there?
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, that totally makes sense that at some point they were able to just walk there. That's the only thing that makes sense. So that's super cool.
Yeah.
That was how they got there. And it turned into this really neat site that was excavated in 1910 to 1911. And in that excavation, which is what we're getting to, that is the recent interesting information, is in that excavation, they found Neanderthal teeth that are from two individuals. I think they originally thought it was one individual, but then upon re-examining them, they found that it's from two individuals. They are about 48,000 years old. And they have characteristics of both Neanderthal and Homo sapien.
Another thing I think is really interesting on this is this was a re-examined collection. Now, I don't know mm-hmm. if there was intent on doing this or when this re-examination actually happened. This was a relatively recently published article. It's technically March 2021 Journal of Human Evolution. So we'll link to that.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know what the cycle was for getting this in there, but we've been talking on the Archaeotech podcast about how research is different right now because people didn't have field seasons over the summer. So there was no excavating pretty much anywhere on the planet. And a lot of collections could be getting reanalyzed or going over stuff that they haven't seen in a while. And I'd like to see if this is one of those things. I don't know if we can know that or not. But this is the kind of cool research that we can get out of re-examining old collections, because you can't assume that something was accurately described.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the farther you go in history and the more people that have looked at it, you can probably assume that, but there's lots of interpretations on things. And also, we know a heck of a lot more about Neanderthals and Homo sapiens than we did in 1910 and 11. And in fact, we didn't even know about Neanderthals in 1910 and 11. Well, we did know about them. They were discovered, I think, in the 1800s in Germany, but the information probably wasn't... We didn't have as many sample specimens to be able to really talk about that.
Yeah, and I don't think that people in 1910 for sure, and even not until, you know, the last decade or so, I'm not sure that people would have been willing to accept that there was interbreeding between Homo sapiens and Neanderthals, because it was just something that was kind of taboo to think mm-hmm. of cavemen, you know, interbreeding with our Homo sapien ancestors. Like, that's just not something that... I think people's minds could even go to, but now there's just more and more evidence of that happening. And these teeth, while they, it's morphology that we're looking at here, so it's mm-hmm. not DNA or anything like that, but the teeth have very Homo sapien characteristics, but the roots and the shape are very Neanderthal. So it's just this sort of combination of the two, which really shows that there probably was some, you know, crossbreeding going on between the two species, which is really neat.
Yeah, and the interesting thing about Neanderthals too is they're often not seen as a species or variant of Homo
mm-hmm.
that is on the Homo sapien line, because there seems to be, you know, as the human evolutionary tree branches out, there is not a straight line. We're not a straight stick, like, you know, well, we're not a straight line down to our earliest common ancestor with the common ancestor we share with chimpanzees. So, you know, we're also not related to chimpanzees, so let's not even go there. We share a common ancestor with
right.
chimpanzees. They have their own complicated tree to deal with.
Right.
And then we have our own complicated tree. And it all goes back to, you know, a couple of beings 20 million years ago that said, hey, you look good. Let's do this thing. and then they had a viable ancestor, right? And then it just went from there. So now... Homo neanderthalensis is on the Homo line, but again, not thought to be directly related mm-hmm. to Homo sapiens. Like, they didn't evolve into Homo sapiens.
Right.
Homo sapiens killed them off, and Homo erectus killed them off.
Right.
As Homo erectus evolved into other things, I think Homo erectus and Homo habilis, maybe? No, I think it was Homo, I can't remember which one, but they were, you know, there's a whole bunch of different ones, but they all, you know... None of them like Neanderthals from the sounds of the archaeological record.
Yeah.
And they haven't been considered a direct line. But DNA evidence in the last 10, 20 years has pointed to a lot of Neanderthal DNA in some primary populations mm-hmm. of the United States, not the United States, of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And now this just goes further to support that theory that I would say it's not necessarily a missing link, because they're not necessarily a link in a direct line of descent, but their DNA is that influence on mm-hmm. our evolution for sure.
Yeah, they definitely are a contributing factor to what, you know, humans eventually evolved into. And I think that it's time to stop disregarding them as being just the stupid cavemen. They're not, sure, I'm sure they were that, but... But they also, you know, as we discussed before, they made string, you know? So, like...
They made string. They made instruments.
Yeah.
Sounds like they made music. They buried their dead in some later instances. I mean, Neanderthals, more than likely, I mean, they had their own culture, for lack of a better word.
Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't be surprised if there was a lot of cultural sharing as well. I'm not going to say Neanderthals and humans or Homo sapiens necessarily lived in the same camps together.
Right.
But then again, why not?
You know?
And mating doesn't always imply consensual mating either. I mean, there's a lot of that going on.
Yeah.
You know, it was very animalistic back then still. And, you know, sometimes, you know, I'm sure they would, I don't know if they would have even have called it rape back then, but it was probably rape.
Mm-hmm.
And like, again, not necessarily non-consensual, but when you got a bunch of hairy beings together, can you really tell one part from the other?
It definitely brings up the question of these offspring of Neanderthal and Homo sapien, like, what was life like for them? Because they clearly would have looked different to both. I wonder if it didn't matter what they looked like and they just were part of the group and that's fine. I wonder, were they ostracized because they looked different? So that would be a behavioral thing that we'll probably never know the answer to, but it is an interesting thing to wonder about.
Well, and again, it's not like they had haircuts back then. And I'm saying that because, sure, they would have looked different in their younger years, or maybe they would have looked so close to both species. Because presumably it wasn't just the teeth, but maybe they look close enough to both that they weren't that different.
Maybe. You know?
Because Homo sapien, even older 30, 45,000 year old Homo sapien, didn't look exactly like we do today. There's still been evolution happening. It's really slow, but they would have looked more Neanderthal than we do, right? Mm-hmm. Even though they weren't. But they would have looked more along the less Homo sapien line. I mean, Homo sapien, I think we go back at least 200,000 years for calling a species Homo sapien. So there'd already been a lot of development down that line. But, and we're closer to when this was found than to the origin of Homo sapiens. But, and I don't know even the current research, maybe it even goes farther back than that. But mm-hmm. Neanderthals are also really old and have been around for a long time. And again, sure, they had the pronounced brow ridges and they had some other traits. I think they were just slightly bigger and bulkier. But you also have bigger and bulky humans, right? Mm-hmm. So aside from the facial traits, and then once the child would have grown up, I mean, they'd have been just as scraggly and hairy as their ancestors, right? As the people around them. So would you even have known something different when you've got crazy eyebrows and hair covering your face?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, who knows?
So...
But yeah, these are very interesting. And I think the one other thing that made this article super interesting to me is that you can't assume that you found the one special example of something.
Had to be common.
It had to be common. So the fact that they found these teeth that show both traits, both Neanderthal and Homo sapien, that means that there must have been a lot more of that out there. So I'm guessing there's just a lot of mixing between the two, especially at that transition zone right before Neanderthals completely died out. These are 48,000 years old, and Neanderthals, I think, are generally accepted they were completely is extinct the right word or gone by?
No, they were extinct.
Extinct by about 40,000 years ago. So this is getting into that transition time, but maybe rather than thinking of them as going extinct, it was more like they were absorbed into the Homo sapien population, or at least whatever traits got passed along from all of the interbreeding that happened. Those got absorbed into the Homo sapien population.
Right. One thing that's interesting about putting this in the not common category, because normally I'd agree with that. Mm-hmm. If you find something like this, it must be common, right? Because what is the chance you're going to find the needle in the haystack?
Yeah.
But there's really one thing that lends it to not, well, two things that lend it to not being that. First off, we don't have a lot of examples of this from what I'm aware of. Mm-hmm. And there are Neanderthals and Homo sapiens all across Europe, right?
Yeah, so that's true.
If we haven't really found a lot of example of this before, why? Why haven't we found that, right? Mm-hmm. The other thing is, as I said, Jersey's an island.
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah, I know where you're going.
If these people happen to live here during one of the time periods where it was really difficult to cross, then these populations wouldn't really have had that much of a choice. Mm-hmm. I mean, I bicycled around Jersey in a day, mm-hmm. right? So you could walk across the whole island in a pretty short period of time. I mean, it would take you the whole day to go if you were to go straight across. But and you could have. There wasn't a lot of veg back then either, probably.
Yeah.
I think there's probably more trees now than there was in the past because it's like a windswept island in the Channel Islands. Mm-hmm. Of course, I don't know what the faunal assemblage or the floral assemblage was back mm-hmm. in there, or even the faunal one for that matter. I know they had fishing technology. There's fish hooks that have been found that are that old, but and probably smaller animals. But even mm-hmm. if there was land, I think that land between Jersey and France, unless it was dry for a really long time, was probably more marshy.
And
periods of wet with maybe even bigger streams going by, because you did have the English Channel on both sides of it mm-hmm. and you did have, you know, periods where there would have been water there. Mm-hmm. So we'd have to look farther back and take some other resources and say, well, what was the geographical situation here at the time?
Yeah, because there's one other option, too, is not that there was both Neanderthal and Homo sapiens on the island, but maybe it was just Neanderthals. But because they were on an island mm-hmm. and there's inbreeding, probably because it's a small population, if they did get locked in by water and they weren't really able to get off the island, then you can get some really funky stuff that happens with island populations.
Yeah.
Genetic drift, I think it's called, right? And
yeah.
And I'm reaching back to my school days when I was studying evolution, but definitely, like, there could be some weird evolution that happened in the population, yeah, which could have resulted independently in these teeth that look a little bit more Homo sapien, but they aren't related to crossbreeding at all. So that is also an option.
Right. All right. Well, that's enough on that. We're going to switch gears entirely for segment three and come back to the United States and talk about using beads as currency. Back in a minute. You may have heard my pitch for membership. It's a great idea and really helps out. However, you can also support us by picking up a fun t-shirt, sticker, or something from a large selection of items from our Tee Public store. Head over to arcpodnet.com/shop for a link. That's arcpodnet.com/shop to pick up some fun swag and support the show. Welcome back to the final segment of the Archaeology Show, episode 110. And as I said, we're moving to Southern California now, coastal Southern California, and the Chumash region. So the Chumash Indians were, prolific along the southern coast. Lots of different tribes of the Chumash and very influential on Southern California. And there's modern Chumash down there now, too. So the Channel Islands, if you've ever heard of those, these are different Channel Islands than we just talked about. But
yeah,
yeah, they're right off. Like, we've seen the Channel Islands actually from the water. If you go out, well, I have actually. I sailed out of Long Beach one time, mm-hmm, and you can see Catalina, which is on one of the Channel Islands. And in mm-hmm fact, if you have an Apple computer and you had the Mac OS Catalina version, the desktop image was one of those islands.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah. So, but the Chumash were, again, very prolific along there. And we're talking about an article that was published in the Journal of Anthropological Archaeology in December of 2020 by Lynn Gamble. And it's called The Origin and Use of Shell Bead Money in California. So shell beads, beads made from shells, mm-hmm, are just everywhere in not only just California, but in surrounding states as well. Mm-hmm. And in fact, didn't we find a bead in northwestern Nevada on a project, on a survey? I thought we found a shell bead, and some people were looking up shell bead resources and trying to figure out if it was a Chumash shell bead.
Yep, that does sound familiar. Yeah. So, yeah.
Well, Lynn, in this article, she mentions that, this was used to pay debts all the way up in, the northwest coast of California, mm-hmm, and presumably beyond. Maybe we just haven't found them yet.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess the initial thoughts on this was using shell beads for money initially started around 800 years ago, but she's proposing that they started 1,000 years earlier, around 2,000 years before present.
Mm-hmm.
And she also mentioned ethnohistoric and ethnographic sources documenting currency used. Now, those can only go back so far.
Right.
There's a lot of oral history amongst tribes because mm-hmm they didn't have a written history, many of them. So there's a lot of oral history. But it has also been pretty well documented that oral history can change through time.
Yeah.
Just by the storytellers, right? Mm-hmm. People tell them and tell them and tell them, but one tiny little detail gets changed. And after the 500th retelling, that tiny detail becomes part of the story.
Change,
yeah,
for sure.
So not to say that they're all completely inaccurate. There is some nuggets of truth in those oral histories, I'm sure of it, but there can be inaccuracies that go along. So when you're trying to figure out something like this, it's one line of evidence, mm-hmm, and you got to go to the archaeology, find additional lines of evidence to support those oral histories. So that's where we're at.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting because by pushing back the date of the use of currency back, 1,200 years to 2,000 years before present now, it's taking tribes that were primarily hunter-gatherer and giving a more sophisticated society to them, because money and currency wouldn't have really been of much use to just a basic hunter-gatherer tribe. So we definitely had a more complex societal structure going on if they're using currency that far back. So for me, this type of story, that's what's really interesting about this type of story. Like, of course, shell beads as currency. Yeah, that's just something that we've known about. But pushing it back that far, it changes how you look at these tribes that were probably considered a little bit more primitive, which primitive is a problematic word, obviously, but they were considered more primitive because they were more hunter-gatherer based. So
Now, some of you might be wondering, because I'm just wondering this right now. Also, that storm we mentioned in segment one is starting to approach, and I'm hearing it on the roof of our RV.
Yes.
And it's getting dramatically darker here.
It really is.
Yeah, so, and it's not even noon yet. But anyway, you got to think about what defines a currency, right?
Yeah.
Because why isn't this just trade? Mm-hmm. We think of currency as money, as coins, as paper, as gold, silver, things that we find precious, right? Mm-hmm. Even jewels like diamonds and stuff. But now you start getting into the realm of actual currency when you start talking about that stuff, because currency to me is something that's, and again, not really looking up the proper definitions of these things from a prehistoric standpoint, but currency is something I think that if you give me beads for something that I either gave you in trade, as you know, maybe I made you a canoe because you don't know how,
right?
Or you've got, you know, a broken arm or something like that, and I've got to hunt for you, I've got to do something, and you have all these beads, and you're like, hey, listen, I'll give you all these beads to do this.
Yeah,
that's trade.
That's
trade. But if I then take those beads and get something else with them, maybe something I couldn't get myself or just don't want to get myself, then that person takes those beads
and they keep going
and it just keeps going. The beads keep shifting hands. That becomes currency.
That becomes currency because it's something that people want and they're willing to trade either other things or services or whatever for it.
Right. And culturally, those beads start having a value. Now it starts becoming, well, you know, 10 beads gets me this, but 20 beads gets me this.
Yeah.
You know?
The development of that system is very interesting. And I'll say here, because we're taking a guess at how this developed, obviously, because we don't know the behavior behind what happened to create this currency. But Miss Gamble here does have four criteria that she uses for assessing whether beads are used for currency or for just simple, you know, jewelry or adornment, right?
That's right, because they say some beads may have just been currency and other beads were
You have to differentiate them when you come across them when you're out there doing the actual archaeology. So her four criteria, I'm going to read this from this article here. Number one is shell beads used as currency should be more labor intensive than those for decorative purposes. Highly standardized beads are likely currency. Bigger eye-catching beads were more likely used as decoration, and currency beads are widely distributed. So that's how she said to approach analyzing beads when you find them in the field and deciding whether or not they were for adornment or for currency.
Yeah, that's interesting, because if you're going to adorn yourself with some fancy beads, couldn't you make something that you could also trade or sell? What do you trade or sell it for? More beads? It gets real complicated, doesn't it?
It does, because it actually gets really personal, too. Because if you have a whole bunch of shells that you want to turn into beads, then are you looking at them like, well, I just want to like look pretty tomorrow, so I'm going to make a necklace. Or are you looking at them as something that you can make for trading or using as currency? So, and I imagine that would become a very personal decision, but I'm not really sure.
Well, what about the rarity of the shells, too? Because that's another thing that makes something more valuable and makes something work as a currency. That's why gold has always been a standard. You know, like coins were actually gold back in the day, right?
Right.
Like they were actually like blends of gold. Or pure gold or something like that. Or silver, you know, whatever.
Yep.
And technically, our currency also represents gold. If you've got a $5 bill in your hand, that represents... Well, we don't really use this strict gold standard anymore because inflation has really wiped that out. But back it used to represent a certain quantity of gold. Mm-hmm. And at some point in our history, you could go to the treasury office or to a bank and exchange that for gold. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just like what it represented. That was called the gold standard. And for a long time, when we started having paper money because it was too difficult to carry gold, or gold became worth less and less, so you had to have something to represent it, because I mean, how many grams of gold can you really give somebody,
right?
You know, and it was just more difficult to handle like that, and that's where inflation comes in. Is $10 now an ounce of gold? I mean, it's obviously way more than that, but just for easy numbers, is $10 an ounce of gold now, or is $20, or is $30? So looking at that, I bet inflation was driven by climate change in the Chumash, right? So they were around doing this for presumably 2,000 years and probably, you know, usually older than we estimate. It's just, you know, we go back as far as we have proof for, which means something developed before that. But the trade in these beads and the rarity of these beads, these shell beads, they're based on shells. And in order to find these shells, you have to go to the places where these shells are. And these shells are living creatures. And their livelihood is dependent on sea temperatures and predators. And everything is dependent on the climate and how many of these shells are being made and produced. How hard are they to gather? How hard are they to, you know, get the little creature out and make them into a fancy little shell bead? You know, I mean, what is the work involved to do this? And, you know, how does, how does that change their value?
And you're talking about like processing the shells into currency or beads, but it makes me wonder, are they using the ones that just wash up on shore and are just already empty of any any animals, or are they taking the shells that are left over from food, you know, gathering or food production? Are they using those shells, or are they actually like finding, like diving into the ocean and finding shells that are pristine, you know?
Well, we go to the rarity of it, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we were just on a beach in South Florida here yesterday where there were the shell beds along this shore were just phenomenal. In fact, we were there looking for shark teeth because a lot of stuff just washes up in a really strict, crazy cycle.
Yeah.
A lot of beaches are just relatively clean because they're nice and flat and they're long. This is a really steep beach, and as you were standing there, you could just see stuff wash up and then also get washed away. And there were thousands of different kinds of shells on the beach.
Yeah, tons of shell, like really thick shell beds washing in.
I just, knowing how people prize rarity, and that has been a trait for, I think, all of history, right? Anytime somebody has recognized value in something, rarity means more value, and that's just because it's harder to get. If it's harder to process, harder to get, like purple from segment one. Purple was hard to get, therefore highly sought after and very expensive.
Yep.
So I would just have to assume that the beads that they're trying to get here were the beads you just didn't find every day, or the beads that were either hard to get or the beads that were hard to process. You know, something like that.
But I would think that those would be the ones that they would save for making jewelry and personal adornment. The shells that they're using to make currency, they tend to all be uniform and similar in size and shape and whatever processing techniques they use on them.
Right, but if they're easy to get, that devalues them. If I don't need to trade for them, I could just go down to the beach and scoop them up.
Well, I think it's the processing part that differentiates them. And you can see that a little bit up in the picture, like how round and smooth down the edges are.
Yeah.
So I think that's part of the reason why, and not everybody was willing to go through the work and effort to make the shells all look like that.
Yeah.
And that is what is interesting about this article, too, is she took a look at shell beads from earlier and was like, wait a minute, we have a whole bunch of these that all look the same and they've been very standardized, and it probably means that they were using them as currency. That's
right,
because otherwise why go to that effort?
I know this storm, I don't know if you can hear the rain on our roof now, but it's gotten pretty intense.
Yeah, it's kind of pouring right now.
Anyway, yeah, it's really interesting thinking about that. And I wonder when they stopped doing that, right? If we have ethnographic accounts, and ethnographic means some people who were doing this or had direct knowledge of people doing this were interviewed by Westerners. That's typically what ethnographic accounts means. And this could have been done in the 1800s, 1700s in Southern California with, you know, early Spanish missionaries and conquistadors and people like that. I don't know where these stories come from, but... And like I said, there are Chumash people still there, right? There's still people that identify as Chumash. Mm-hmm. So the ethnographic accounts, I mean, how far back could those go? And were they still using beads as currency at that time? Or was stuff like the, was the Little Dryas happened, I think, in the 1400s or something like that, also known as the Dark Ages in Europe. And, you know, all this time with this short period of climate change, I wonder if that would have taken the shell bean industry down and caused a waning in those shells, and even either made them more valuable or caused them to go to a different kind of currency for trade. You know, it's interesting to say because they're clearly not using shells for currency now.
Right.
You know, although there are Native American groups that make things in the traditional style that they do sell. So in a way it's currency, but they're not really currency. Like, they're trading it for real money.
It's more like art at that point.
Yeah.
So
that's what it's become.
Yeah.
Which really blurs the lines even back in the day. Cause if you're also using beads, as we said, for jewelry and clothing, you know, like decoration on clothing and stuff, weaving beads in, it's like, how is that not still kind of currency, right? If you just trade the thing that you made.
Yeah.
You know, like processed beads. I feel like that'd be more valuable.
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of, it's all kind of wrapped up in there together, because I'm sure you could take a really beautifully created necklace or something that you could wear on your body and and trade that for whatever you need. So then it becomes kind of currency too. But yeah, there's a lot of twisted up stuff there.
So let's leave you with a little thought experiment. Let's say that COVID-20 hits. We're done with COVID-19.
Oh, God. What a horrible thing to say.
COVID-20 is the zombie apocalypse. And our society is completely wiped out, right? Infrastructure, everything's gone. We no longer have, you know, money as we think of it. Mm-hmm. We're basically living in tribes again, and we're just like, you know, on
it's
our
the stand.
Own. There's no, yeah.
It's basically the stand.
There's no government. There's no anything, right? So there's no real national or international currencies or anything anymore.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think we'd use as currency now? What would be the valued thing that people want? I mean, and I'm not talking like food and resources. I'm talking we're 50 years into this thing, right? We're 50 years into this thing. So we're a generation or two in. And what would the currency
batteries.
Just... Batteries. You think tech is still a thing?
Well, 50 years in, there's still going to be things.
Batteries is interesting.
Things that you could put batteries into and they would work. Like flashlights. I mean, if you keep a flashlight in good working condition, all you need is a battery and that baby is working.
How about, do you want better? Solar panels.
Ooh. Yeah, but you need batteries for the solar panels.
Well, I mean, hopefully the lithium's still kicking back up and then. The lead acids are probably well dead, but
yeah.
I don't know if the lithium will keep it rolling.
I think we need to write a sci-fi fantasy series based on batteries as currency.
the church of the solar panel cult.
Right.
And then there's the Reformed Church of the Solar Panel cult.
Oh, man.
That's a deep Monty Python reference.
That went off the rails. So
what do you think would be our currency 50 years after the next apocalypse?
Yeah.
And it happens now. The apocalypse happens now. I said apocalypse. So the apocalypse happens now. And 50 years go by. You're probably dead, so don't worry about it. But your kids.
Yeah.
What, or your grandkids more likely. Like, what is their hot commodity? What is their currency? And I don't mean something that's just valued and treasured. Like, when we say solar panels and batteries, I'm not sure you'd be trading those for things, right? So currency has to be something that's not only rare, but also abundant. At the same time, right? Or involves some sort of processing, because you're literally trading this for food. You're trading it for clothing. You're trading it for other supplies.
Yeah.
I don't think I would trade away my solar panels for anything, right? Unless we had enough solar panels that it was like not hard to find
those. Well, that's why it's got to be batteries, not solar panels.
Yeah, yeah, probably. Right. So
give me those triple A's.
Wow. Wow. I don't know what you're powering with the AAA, but anyway. All right. Well, that's it for this episode. We're going to come back next week and talk about the Netflix movie, The Dig. So if you haven't seen it, go check it out. And if you want to know the punchline, because they don't actually mention it throughout the entire movie, but this is Sutton Hoo. Look up Sutton Hoo, which H-O-O, which is a site in southeastern England, and it's probably one of the most important sites in all of England. Mm-hmm. And this is the story of the original discovery that kicked off 80 years of research at this place. So go check it out. Look up Sutton Hoo at the beginning, and you'll have a little better understanding of what they're finding and why it's so important and why it's cool. I wish they had gotten into that in the movie, but we'll talk about that next week.
We will talk about that for sure.
Yeah. So thanks for joining us, and we will see you next time. Thanks for listening to The Archaeology Show. Feel free to comment and view the show notes on the website at www.arcpodnet.com. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at arcpodnet. You can also find us on the Lyceum app, a podcast app just for educational podcasts. Music for this show is called I Wish You Would Look from the band Sea Hero. Again, thanks for listening and have an awesome day. This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV Traveling America, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US dollars a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to archpodnet.com/members for more info.